Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, New Zealand's favourite guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Good evening, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cinematica. My name is Dan Slevin, and today's program is our very special Best of 2012 episode. This is where Simon and Kaylee and I and some special guests get together to discuss what sort of a year 2012 has been for those of us that like going to the movies. Should point out that Simon is currently on a beach somewhere, so he has already pre-recorded his contribution to today's show. Kaylee is in Canada, and she managed to get her datelines wrong, so she's recording her bit tomorrow. We'll drop her into the show before we actually stick it out on the internet. And with us on the line from Auckland, New Zealand, is from the Sunday Star Times, Sarah Watt. G'day, Sarah.
Hi, Dan.
Nice to have you on board. And with me in the Cinematica studio, we have from the New Zealand listener, David Larson.
G'day, Dan. Nice to be here.
And from Wellington's Dominion Post, I suppose that's New Zealand's Dominion Post, isn't it, the chief film critic?
The only
film critic for the Dominion Post. It's Graham Tuckett. Graham, welcome to Cinematica.
Hi, good to be here.
So, we're also going to be getting a little bit later on a contribution from our first international correspondent, Glenn Kenny, who is a former chief film critic for Premiere Magazine and the chief film critic for MSN.com, will be making his contribution, a sort of New York perspective on the year in movies a little bit later on. But first, we'll start off, I think we'll break this up into four bits, and we'll do the four bits person by person. So perhaps David first, if you could let us know, what's been your favourite film of the year?
That is just the most horrible question to ask me, Dan, because if I have to pick one film, I have to pick one film, only one film, one film. Okay.
Yes.
Then I have to give the most boring answer imaginable, because I'm going to come out and say the film of the year for me was the one that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. How boring is that? I'm not going outre, I'm not going strange, I'm not going out of left field. It's Amour. I saw Amour and I thought, yes, I have seen the best film of the year.
And you knew that when you saw it?
I knew that as soon as it ended. I knew that as I sat there shivering in my seat trying to recover my emotional equanimity. It was just instantly obvious.
This is a great film. Yeah, this is a film that I think had a massive impact on lots of people who saw it, particularly people of a certain age. If your parents are of a certain age, as mine are, you start wondering, it really does hit home and ask some questions, doesn't it? Graham?
Well, boy, you want to hear a downer. The reason I didn't see Amour is because my mother died the day I was supposed to go and see it. So.
Oh, my God.
So to this day, I have yet to see Amour, but I think if it does, I can't even imagine why it hasn't been picked up by a New Zealand distributor. At least
it has been, and it's being released February 28th.
Oh, that's a scoop, because I don't think anybody's actually got that one on the list that have gone out to people yet. So,
come February the 28th, I will very, very happily go and see it. Michael Haneke hasn't made a film that I haven't adored yet, so I'm sure I will. It'll be 8 months, I'll be about ready for it.
Yeah. Talking of Cannes, Sarah, you saw it at Cannes, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Among other little gems.
I felt the same way
David did. I mean, there was no doubt at the end of it that that was something intense and very special and flawless. And I don't want to make it my best film of the year, A, because David's already done it, but B, because it was kind of like the easiest home run in a way for Michael Haneke, because it was flawless. There was nothing that I would have done or advised him to do differently or better. So can I choose a different film for my number one?
Absolutely. What we'll do is we'll come around to you in a wee while, because I think do person by person, and you can contribute and you can argue or diss a particular choice. But I was going to ask David now, if you could, what was your biggest surprise of the year? What was the film that you maybe weren't expecting much from, but actually but blew you away, or maybe in reverse, the biggest disappointment of the year? Because we watch so many films and we sort of have a fair idea what we're going to expect before we go in, so it is unusual to be taken by surprise.
Okay, well, I'm going to go with a film by a director I'd never actually heard of, so it wasn't anything that I had any particular expectations of. I just booked a ticket for it because it was between two other things at the film festival that I wanted to see, and I needed to bridge the gap. It was called The Loneliest Planet, written and directed by, actually directed by Julia Lochtev. I think she adapted it from a short story. It's about a couple of tourists in the wilds of Georgia, former Soviet Union. They're traveling the backcountry with a single native guide, and it just completely blew me away. Gorgeous cinematography, really, really interesting editing and direction, and a very, very perceptive, insightful, trying to think of other synonyms for perceptive, study of a relationship and of tourism, I suppose, really, of the whole business of going out and treating the world as your playground and expecting it to play nice with you.
This is interesting because that's two films that you've chosen that were very much festival films, one of which we've been hanging out for news of its return, and one that I don't think that is likely to return to New Zealand cinemas on a commercial basis. And I think that that's been one of the things that I've noticed this year. When I was putting my Capital Times list together for the first time in 6 years, doing my best of the year, usually I exclude films that are festival only because it doesn't seem fair. Mm. But if I did exclude all the festival films, then it would have been a very short piece. Mm. So this is something that is kind of interesting. Well, maybe you could tell us, David, what of the multiplex films that you saw this year that have stayed with you or that you were impressed by?
Top of my head? Geez, I don't know. not in the sense that there's nothing, bastards. In the sense that there are so many.
Oh, right, you're out for that Literate magazine.
Damn you, I love the Avengers.
Come down and wrestle in the mud with us, Lars. Come on down to the popcorn.
Cabin in the Woods, how's that?
Never saw it.
Well,
you snob, Tucker.
It didn't get a general release, David. It doesn't.
Yeah,
count.
No, I think exactly, because I think Sarah's just pointed out Cabin in the Woods didn't get a general release either. No, that was festival only. So,
I do hope you'll agree with me that that's scandalous.
It is. Yeah. No question that it is a scandal and one of many.
It's not just a scandal. It's just bloody surprising. It's like if that is not going to be a popular film, if somebody picks it up, then what is? You know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's hard to know, isn't it?
Actually, tell you another little film that definitely was multiplex fair, although it's a foreign language film, so it didn't get a huge release, and that's The Raid.
Mm. Right.
Oh, I really awesome. Enjoyed mm-hmm. The Raid.
Yeah, very good choice, very good choice. And actually, on a similar basis, a sort of a multiplex film that didn't necessarily get as much attention. It took a long while getting here, and I think that its audience had sort of disappeared by the time it arrived. It was Attack the Block, which was also an action movie with lots of entertainment, a bit of ticker about it as well, a bit of heart and social conscience about it.
And it had only been downloaded about 3 million times in New Zealand by the time it made it here, 18 months after UK release.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, that was one I was happy somebody did pick up and give general distribution, because it must have just about missed out completely.
It was really good seeing that film with an audience, I have to say.
Yeah, likewise. Mm. Well, rather than just on YouTube.
All right.
Couldn't possibly comment.
Time for a little bit of a break now from our live guests, and we will now talk to a regular host of the show, Kaylee, who's sitting in snowy Canada, and she can tell us a little bit about her year at the movies. Kaylee, I was just going to say welcome to Cinematica, but actually you're no stranger to the show.
No. I feel a bit foreign at the moment, though. It's funny, I'm recording live from, quote in quotations, live from Vancouver, and it's strange going back home and being a foreigner in your own city. It's an interesting experience.
Are you a tourist?
I am looking at all the
things that are changing.
Yeah, I went out for lunch with a friend yesterday, and I was like, what should I, do I go order? Like, do we sit here? Should I do something? And then you have to tip, and it's just like, ugh. It's so stressful.
And have you had a chance to go to see any movies yet?
No, I haven't. I've been sleeping and meeting my brand new little baby niece who is 4 months old and is very loud, but very happy at the same time. So,
anything on the plane that you can report back on?
What? I watched Scarfies, so I've now watched that, which was very enjoyable.
That's a goodie, actually. That is a good one.
Yeah, I was quite impressed, and I fell asleep during the Simpsons movie, thanks to some legal pharmaceuticals to ease the journey, and then I watched The Hunger Games again just because I know it was entertaining fluff. So,
All right. Well, maybe that will show up in your best of 2012, which we shall start now. Everybody else on the show, we're asking them what their number one film is first. What was the one that you want to represent 2012 going forward?
Oh, that's a tough one. I actually made a top five today. I went back through all the cinematic episodes and wrote down my top five films. Number one. Ooh. Oh, that's a tough one. I think, looking at the list, I think I'm going to have to go with A Separation. That came out at the beginning of the year, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did, actually. And I'm just trying to remember which order that we're going to play you between you and Simon, but I think you might be surprised or horrified to know that you have both chosen the same film.
Ah, we were discussing it before I left, and we couldn't decide whether it came out in 2011 or 2012.
It was a 2011. Yeah, it was a 2011 film festival picture, 2011 Cannes picture, I think, but 2012 in cinemas here. So yeah, no, that counts. That's all good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it came in a very close second with, I think, a tie between Monsieur Lazare and The Skin I Live In, because The Skin I Live In just absolutely blew me away.
What an interesting choice.
Mm.
And that's because I don't think we actually discussed The Skin I Live In at any, like, we didn't give it as much depth of a discussion as we have some other films on the show. What was so cool about The Skin I Live In from your point of view?
I think it was, from memory, I think it's the first Almodovar film that I've actually sat down properly to watch in a cinema. And it's just stuck with me the entire year. It's just the visual aspect, that fantastic, like, turn, like, plot, is, you know, the plot twist at the end. I just really enjoyed it, and I can't get it out of my head. It's stuck with me all year, so it's definitely up there. And of course, Monsieur Lazare, fantastic French Canadian film dealing with a very, very heavy subject in a very sensitive and very beautiful way. And I always am a sucker for really good performances from young actors. So,
indeed. Next question for you is, there's been a lot of talk around the show about the strength of the art house this year and the strength of the festival titles. But what was your highlight at the multiplex? Of the big Hollywood releases, which one stands out for you?
That would have to be The Artist, which we got at the beginning of the year. That was a big one. That was a really big one. It's more of an art house than a multiplex, but it wasn't a crossover,
it was crossover due to if it hadn't have been snapped up by on the awards circuit, maybe it would have been a relatively minor release. Do you think? It certainly got hyped quite early, didn't it? So of the studio movies, which ones do you think really stood out for you? You talked about the Hunger Games was obviously worth going to twice, or going back to.
Yeah, I mean, I read the book, so I knew I would enjoy it watching it on the flight. Brave's in my top five. I think Brave will be number five in my top five this year. I really enjoyed that. I think I may have said that it was in my top five when it did come out, just because that great heroine aspect, that fantastic animation from Pixar, and just, yeah, as soon as those sweeping 3D Irish landscapes started, I was tearing up. So,
or Scottish, depending on you.
Oh, sorry. God, Scottish. This time travel thing is difficult.
That's like me saying you're in America.
I know. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Brave.
People of Scotland, we apologize to you all.
I should know. I'm quarter Scottish somewhere way back.
Well, this brings me to a trend, I guess. Something else that we're asking all of our guests is, what do you think you've noticed as a major trend for the year? Perhaps it might be the strong female central characters that have come through.
No, there aren't quite, still aren't really enough strong female characters. No. This year, I think we can definitely say the trend again, which has followed on for the last couple of years, is still graphic novels and comic book adaptations, and really, really big budget ones as well. What else did we see? I think I remember having a discussion this year on Cinematica about was it about the this oh, like unaccompanied children or unattended minors, something along those lines.
Oh, kids on their own at the cinemas, actually watching, being annoying, or kids on their own in films themselves.
In films, like children who are sort of left to their own devices, or are in the plot but are kind of forgotten for long periods of time, and was like, what happened to their child? Is someone minding it? Like, what's?
What was the biggest surprise that you had, like positive or negative? What was so was there something that you saw that you had really high hopes for but turned out to be a disappointment, or was there something that you saw that you had no expectations for and turned out to blow you away?
I think Holy Motors has to be up there, of one of those ones going into, I wasn't originally really planning on watching it, then it turned into this humongous social event, and it just, I enjoyed it because it, just the varied reactions to it. I found it really funny. I took it really lightly and was taken on this crazy, crazy mind trip of a ride. And I think I quoted someone who reviewed it as saying, it's like I opened my mind to go see it and the director farted into my brain.
Now carry on.
Which you know, pretty much explains what happens. It's a, like, you just feel like you were kind of sort of farted on.
Yeah, I don't know if that's quite exactly the way I would put it, but definitely something similar. So what are your plans before we get together for the next show? Are you looking at what's playing locally so that you can report back to us on new titles? Are you going to get to see any of the big Christmas New Zealand releases, for example, Les Miserables, anything like that playing local to you?
Let me just check. I did have a quick look before I left. Let's see what is playing right now, which I can go see. I see Jack Reacher. I could do that. Cirque is playing right now. The Guilt Trip, which I don't know if is getting a New Zealand release. It's a Seth Rogen comedy.
No sign of that one.
Rust and Bone is playing. I could go see that.
Oh, yes, do.
Ooh. Silent Night, a horror film with Malcolm McDowell.
Wow.
And This Is 40. So.
Right. Yes, which I think comes out a little bit later for New Zealand audiences. So this is going to be an interesting few weeks. You're overseas for how long?
I will be there. I'll be here. There. I don't know where I am. I will be in Vancouver until the 24th of January. So I'll be here for a while. Oh, I'm also looking. I can go see Anna Karenina now.
Ah, good one.
Ooh,
yes. Well, we're looking forward to talking about that one pretty soon as well. So lots to look forward to on the show. Lots to look forward to on your trip. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy holiday to join us on the show.
Yes, it's very stressful. I have to go for social drinks coming up next. So, you know.
All right. Take care. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dan.
So let's go to our next guest from the Sunday Star Times, Sarah Watt. Sarah, your top movie of the year, the one that you think should define the year or define your experience of the movies.
In a way, I regret that this is a documentary, because I still sort of consider documentary to be a subset of movies, and it would be wonderful to say that there was a fiction film out there that was the most awesomest, but in this instance, I'm going with Searching for Sugar Man. It was the film that I think all the crowd, we watched it all together at the opening of the film festival, and we all walked out just jaw on the ground, and I remember getting the album off a South African friend the very next day, and it's the one film I told my non-cinema going dad all about it, word for word, and he was interested, and I recommended it without any kind of condition whatsoever. I've basically said, if you've got two eyes and any sort of brain, you will love this story. And I think that is very, very, I just think that's magnificent. It's so universal and so profound. I thought Searching for Sugar Man was the business.
You've made me feel really terrible for the fact that I didn't actually like it that much now. I feel stink. Because you've sold it to me so well. And if I hadn't already seen it, I would be, oh, let's go out and watch that. So, unfortunately, I felt like I'd been played a bit at the end of it.
Really?
Yes.
I did say if you've that, got two Dan, eyes and a
brain, because
Dan,
you've
so,
been
you know,
played.
I gave you an out there. But
yeah, true, true.
It's
yeah.
Dan with his four eyes and has an enormous brain.
So Graham, I'm with Dan. Do you want to side up there with Sarah and we can go two on two?
You would be, David.
I'm cuddling up to Sarah on this one. I thought yeah. Searching for Sugar Man was, I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant achievement. I was lucky in that I didn't know anything about the subject at all.
Same.
Other than the fact, I once had a South African flatmate who used to play, what's his name?
Rodriguez.
Rodriguez, thank you. Rodriguez albums back to back because only the South Africans knew about him. So that one, I didn't know the story. I mean, the first 5 minutes of the film, I assumed also that this man must be dead. So the revelation of the third act caught me out just as it caught everyone else out.
Yeah, it was nicely played. It was nicely structured.
It was
a good bit of myth making.
If you didn't know the story, it was a fantastic bit of myth making. I'm sure it elided and compressed and did all those things that documentary makers want to do. But
I was just left with so many questions about the man, and they were not questions that would have been that hard to answer had they wanted to. But they weren't making the film about the man; they were making the film about the myth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I like the myth. The only thing I could ever compare it to was. The Devil and Daniel Johnson, which it reminded me of immensely, and I found it almost as moving as that. Right. And The Devil and Daniel Johnson is just about flat out one of my favourite films ever. So,
Sarah, The Multiplex, your audience at the Sunday Star Times, they're people who presumably like to be told about what's going on in commercial cinema as well as in the festival. So what were you recommending to them this year?
I was very pro David Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I'm not saying wasn't saying it was the best film of the year, but I really thought for once somebody is vindicated in making an American version of a foreign film.
It was 10 times better, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was.
I thought so. And I remember you, David, writing that it was so good that when you came out the cinema, you vowed to see it again or something like that.
Vowed to see it again, and I got tickets to see it again. And on the day, I forget what came up. I think it was a bloody media screening, but I couldn't. So my second viewing remains to occur, as is so often the way.
So does mine.
But I am keen. I'm really hoping that he'll do the second film.
I went back to see it a second time, but just for the opening five couple of minutes and the credit sequence. What is it with David Fincher and credit sequences? By God, he's good. It's like the first 90 seconds of Seven, I think, is still the strongest 90 seconds of the whole film.
This has been a big year for superhero movies. Sarah, was there any of the big costume lycra epics that appealed to you?
I thought, I know everyone thought the Avengers Assemble was great. I thought it was great, but I didn't adore it.
You're giving
I
it
really
the British
liked
title
the
there,
new
Sarah.
Spider-Man. I like the Spider-Man reboot. I thought that was somewhat vindicated. You know, why would we do another one of those? We've had Tobey Maguire do it three times, and they went back to the beginning and revisited the sort of the origin story, if you will, although they changed it significantly. Mm. And I thought that was really good. And I saw it on a big enough screen, as you do, that when he was flying through the air, through the city, it was fantastic. So I thought that was a good superhero one. I thought Bond, does he count? I thought Bond's great. I love Bourne, but they're not really superheroes, are they? They're just kind of like real men.
No, yeah. Bourne's an interesting one because he's sort of a manufactured, but both of them, they're sort of manufactured superheroes in that they've got powers that normal people don't have. So I suppose you could call them superheroes in that sense. They're origin stories and they go through all of the same sort of all the same tropes. What was your biggest surprise of the year, Sarah? What was the one that you just came out of nowhere? Or
the biggest
went to nowhere?
Well, no, came out of nowhere for me. The biggest surprise for me is I shouldn't even admit this in public, I've become a little bit of a judge a book by its cover kind of person. I guess maybe that's what happens. And I turned my nose up at actually three art house films. Angel's Share, the Ken Loach film. The Untouchables, that French one, with François Cluzet and Omar Sy, and Beasts of the Southern Wild. None of them did I want to see. I thought, oh, how trite. But as for Beasts, I thought, oh, you know, magical realism, shaky cam, fantasy bollocks, quite frankly. And I went to see the film, and it was amazing. So there you go. Those people at the Cannes Film Festival and all the other festivals, they actually do know what they're talking about. So that was my big lesson learned.
So your cynicism was challenged effectively this year.
Yeah, and the Angel's Share, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I laughed and laughed at any of the dialogue I could understand, and thought it was a terrific romp. So, and yet I had rejected seeing it on two occasions prior to being forced to see it in a press screening, and I loved it. So there you go. Don't listen to me.
What was your preconception about the Angel's Share, Sarah?
Oh, God. All I'd seen was snippets of a trailer, which is even worse. Hadn't even seen the whole trailer. I'd seen snippets of a trailer, and I thought, all this is going to be is a whole lot of working-class Scottish lads larking about in kilts drinking whiskey. And that was all I knew of it. I really like Ken Loach, David, and I did like... not Searching for Eric Mann. Oh, yeah, Searching for Eric, right?
Looking for Eric, yeah.
Searching for Eric Mann.
That's a much better title.
That's the new South Park movie.
Or the Jamaican version, Searching for Eric Mann.
I thought it might be the new superhero movie.
Yeah, so I don't know.
Origin of Eric Mann.
I'd seen a bit of the trailer and I just thought, oh, well, that's just going to be completely frivolous and stupid, silly slapstick comedy. And obviously I'm far too highbrow for that. But how wrong I was.
Right. Well, that's that Angel's Share trailer, in fact, the Angel's Share marketing all round, I think, did not represent the finished film particularly effectively by comparing it to the full Monty and, you know, in kilts and what have you. I just got the impression it was very different to what the finished film was, particularly if you watch the first 20 minutes of the Angel's Share. It's full on Ken Loach in his kitchen sink, bloody
social realism and comment on class war.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that full Monty strap line? That was just irretrievably misguided, wasn't it?
It was.
It's like,
yeah.
Oh, it's from the British Isles. How do we sell it to the Americans? What was the last thing out of there that made a buck? Mm. I will say it's like the full Monty.
Yeah, very, very disappointing.
Yeah.
All right, time to talk to another of the regular hosts of the show. And he's on a beach at the moment, enjoying his Christmas holidays. But a couple of days ago, we chatted to Simon about his pick of the year. 2012, what sort of a year has it been for you? Have you enjoyed yourself at the movies?
Yeah, I have. I thought it's been a healthy year with a nice variety in there in the mix. I think it's been a good year. I look at, you know, looking ahead, I think that it's more of the same. So I'm really optimistic confident about what we've got on offer and what we've had.
Yeah. What was your, favourite experience? What is the one night at the movies which you're going to sort of remember forever?
Whoa, forever?
Forever. Come on.
Well, I mean, if you're looking at 2012, I mean, one of the films that was a big standout for me, from, you know, a kind of fresh, interesting look at the world from a different perspective, I thought A Separation for me was a really rewarding film.
I'm so glad it got a wider release, actually. Yeah, and it deserved that audience.
So worthy. And such a, you know, fascinating look at another part of the world, which we don't often get to see. And I love films from that part of the world.
And how those people are the same but different.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, the more films like that, the better in some ways. You know, people sort of get a bit more wiser about what's around them. So I felt that was, you know, that was a real standout for me, really real standout. And just such a neat sort of high quality sort of offer.
What was the biggest surprise for you, do you think?
Biggest surprise. Oh, geez.
Yeah, you've got your list in front of you. The thing is, I should point out to audiences that when you see four or five films a week, as I do, and a similar number that Si does, that they do all seem to blend into one after a while.
Hugo.
Oh,
would
right.
have to be a big surprise for me. Well, you know, even though there was a lot of pre-hype, it still went beyond delivering for me.
And calendar watchers, I should point out that Hugo was released in 2012 in New Zealand, so it does count as this year, even though I think it got out a lot earlier overseas.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed Hugo. Brought a tear to the eye. So, I was looking back through all of this, and I thought, you know, there's so many films, like there's, Shame, that was so strong and powerful, and Martha Marcy, May and Marlene. There's a lot of good films in there, but
good choice. That's one that I don't know if enough people got to see.
Oh, no, it was really a very powerful film, really good. But you know, from a just a light really fun, kind of bubbly night at the movies where you come out with a smile on your face, you know, and a good boost to the help to make the industry healthy. I thought for me, the best exotic Marigold Hotel.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that. That's funny. Good call.
I mean, I like to mix up a bit of art with a bit of box office sort of, you know, like
I have to say that possibly, I mean, I did quite enjoy the Marigold Hotel, and it was nice to see all those twinkly English actors doing the business there. Yeah. But I must admit that if somebody said to me, "Oh, we're going to have a double feature, we're going to have salmon fishing in the Yemen and the best exotic Marigold, the best of British," I imagine I would be asleep before the lights went down.
I'm captivated. A glint in my eye, and I just sit there and watch. No, because that in some ways they're what it's about. You know, they're just really fun, sort of warm nights out. You know, they provide a smile on the face, and that's, you know, another one that I would say was a bit of a surprise though was The Hunger Games, and how, you know, that was quite a.
And that's a film that's not aimed at your demographic.
No, not at all. But I thought that was a film that was quite smart and kind of had a really strong political undercurrent. So I was surprised that for that type of blockbuster release
to have that subtext.
Yeah. And of course, can I say one more?
Yeah, of course. Keep going.
2012. Well, Bond.
Right. Yeah.
Skyfall, you know, hits it out of the park. More box office gold. there's a small selection.
All right. What was the biggest disappointment of the year?
Well, there's a few. I mean, I don't like sort of putting the boot into other films.
I'll go on. It's Christmas.
Well, I mean, you know, old JC from Mars was pretty frightening. He kind of did some damage. You know,
and took up a bit of space.
Yeah, and there were a couple of films like that, I guess. I mean, I remember sitting through Jack and Jill with my kids. I was like, oh my goodness, this is like frightening. But you know, on the whole, I mean I haven't even mentioned films like Descendants, which was pretty good as well, wasn't it? So I mean, it was, you know, it's that whole kick off to the year. You got these really strong titles like Tinker
and it's,
Tailor,
and it's difficult to look back that far and actually remember what they were.
It is, isn't it? You've really got to do the research, do some work,
yeah,
have a good look.
You've got to do some prep, Simon. I tell you what, there was no film worse for me than Killer Elite this year. Yep. That was a stinker.
Yep.
Did you feel like
Wrath of the Titans?
Oh yes.
See, there's a few, isn't
it? It does. Let's not go down that rabbit hole. What are you looking forward to most in the new year? Like, I know you've seen a few already of the big January titles.
Well, you know, I haven't seen Les Mis yet, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
I think that'll just be really exciting, and also just curious about it, because you know you've got these actors that, you know, this is a musical, and how they can make that transition and pull it off to an audience that will be quite kind of, you know, they'll have seen the show and they'll have a high expectation. So I think really looking forward to how that sort of plays out. There's a few titles like Rust and Bone and that I think, you know, hopefully gets released in the new year. And I'm quite keen to see that. I haven't seen the New Zealand film yet, Mount Zion, which is meant to be coming out in the new year, which, you know, locally made. So I'll be interested in that. So there's, you know, there's quite a few.
And Shopping as well.
Shopping
is another New Zealand film, which apparently has just been invited to Berlin as well as Sundance.
Yeah, which is fantastic. So I think, you know, it's always good to see those titles kind of break out and do well. And so I'm looking forward to that sort of mix of films. I mean, Shopping, I remember going on set and having a look at that. It was very interesting. Yeah, so There's a bit there to keep us busy.
Indeed. Thanks very much, Simon. Enjoy your break.
Thank you.
That's Simon Wherry, usual host of Cinematica, and pre-recorded a little bit earlier on in the week with his rundown of the best of 2012. And I've noticed that there are a few suggestions in there that raised the eyebrows around the table. that was my suggestion. Was it Salmon Fish in the Yemen? The Great Magnolia Hotel, whatever it was called.
No, I liked that film. Thank you very much.
Okay, so David, so that got... That,
I'm not saying I disliked it, but anyone who puts it on top 10 of the year has got at least one eye on the cash register and might just be a cinema chain. I don't think I'm out of line saying that, am I?
Sarah, was there anything?
I missed it. I'm going to be renting it over Christmas, actually, and watching it with my slightly elderly parents, who thought it was wonderful.
Well, then I think in that company, it'd probably be entirely appropriate.
You could barely hear the dialogue for the false teeth falling on the laps. It was
fantastic. So, Graham Tuckett from the Dominion Post, you've heard a few other people's opinions. Notice I'm going last. Because I'm the host.
I was going to say, I've been interrupting everybody, now it's my turn to suffer. But
yep.
My film of the year, and I think, look, you're always going to be a little bit biased with these things, especially if you're too goddamn lazy to really do your homework and pick something you've seen probably in the last 3 or 4 months rather than the entirety of the last 12 months. I did remember that I'd seen Hugo this year, and it's made my top 10 for the paper. But my favourite film of the year, without too much thought about it, because it's just such an easy pick, is Beast of the Southern Wild. I absolutely adored that thing from beginning to end. Now, to give you a bit of a, maybe a slight out clause from me, I saw Beast of the Southern Wild 30 minutes after I'd sat through 3 hours of The Hobbit at 48 frames per second in 3D.
Whoa.
So it was the equivalent of like, well, I've just watched somebody else play a video game for 3 hours. I drove through half an hour of rush hour traffic to get from Wellington to Petone. I don't know, rush hour will make you Aucklanders laugh because, you know, for us it's, there's a cat on the road, we'll have to slow down.
but a bicycle and a tumbleweed.
yes, dear. And then got out there and walked in, and by some lucky coincidence, Simon's sound operator or projectionist had turned the volume up just a bit too loud, and it was a great film to watch at ear-bleeding volume. It was just like a bucket of ice-cold fresh shrimp in the face. I loved it. It was. I loved the shaky cam. I loved the just the child's perspective it brought to it. The kid whose name I will not even attempt to pronounce, who played Hush Puppy, I thought was a force of nature. And finding out the next week, when I finally got around to doing a bit of reading about it, that the guy who played Wink, her dad, was actually the baker who lived over the road, who was providing them with donuts for their casting sessions, and having drawn a blank with these name actors from Louisiana, said, actually, the baker's got a good look on him, let's get him over to read, and shooting around his bread baking schedule to get for his interior shots.
It was all about finding someone who could play with the kid, apparently. Yeah. I had a chance to chat with the director earlier in the year, and he told me that the first few people they got in to read for the part, they did some of the fight scenes with the little girl, and the actors wanted to go a bit method on it. They wanted to really get into the character, stay in the character, and she was terrified, and she just shut down.
Yeah.
Whereas he has kids of his own, he knew how to play with her.
He knew how to play it on camera, but
made
also
it be fun.
Bring himself back off camera sort of thing.
Because the intensity that they managed together, it's just riveting.
I know, you can't believe this kid is actually standing up to the force of nature, which is the dad. And then very, very quickly you realise the kid is every bit the force of nature that he is. Mm. And when you get the flash of the woman who may or may not be the mother, it just tied together beautifully. I was crying my eyes out the last 10 minutes, and yet really moved by
this,
it as well.
Yeah, this is a film that I'm very much looking forward to seeing again. The first time that I saw it, I think
well,
I was...
Well, don't raise your expectations again.
Well, no, I saw it at the film festival, and I got my ticket very late and ended up very close to the screen at the embassy.
Yeah.
And apart from the fact that once you're downstairs at the embassy, you're leaning back a lot, which I don't find very comfortable anyway.
But there is something about festival screenings over above just standard public screening as well. Oh, some days you just can't move for the air of self-congratulation in the audience. So look at us, we're at the film festival.
But the vibe was good. It was the first night of the main night of the film festival after the gala, and people. It was a packed house. I just felt a little bit motion sick just by being so close to the screen. So that's one that I really want.
Loads of people.
Yeah, I
sat at the back.
I will. Next time around, I'll be a little bit further back.
Well, I saw it out here at the Lighthouse Petone, and it was halfway back, place almost to myself. Loved it. So.
Yeah, fantastic. So, Graham, the best time you had at the multiplex this year?
Best time at the multiplex this year. I'm tempted to say Avengers. Hey, can I just put a little move in for Police, because that was my other contender for film.
Oh, right, yes. We just talked about that on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Lot of people have been writing Police off as being nothing but a bad time, and I think you actually, Mr. Slevin, might be one of them. And I found the film very, very, very funny in places, and I don't think that's been emphasised enough, is that Police really knows how to leaven the message with some real dark humour, real gallows humour, but it's there. And I'm just hugely admired. I think it easily could have been 20 minutes shorter. There's a few storylines that really didn't need to make it onto screen, but I love that
film. Like Ma Wen casting herself, but yes.
Ah, she works. Any film that after sort of an hour has earned enough audience goodwill so that you can have a scene in which someone in a nightclub takes off her glasses and makes her shake her hair out and then says, admittedly in French, ah, wow, but you're beautiful. And get away with it with a straight face and not play that for comedy. I go, that's a big stock of goodwill you just blew, but he got away with it.
Yeah. Well, good choice. Not so, a multiplex one, though, so let's try and draw you back.
Draw me back. Happy at the multiplex. Killing Them Softly, I think, would be the... I mean, I'm not a member of the Brad Pitt fan club by any stretch of the imagination. I think the last film that he was any good in whatsoever in a serious role was Seven. I think he's the worst actor since Ronald Reagan to have achieved any sort of stardom. I quite like him in comedies when he's sending himself up. So I went to see Killing Them Softly yet again, going, it'll be Moneyball, it'll be a potentially good film that's completely ruined by having that shaved ape in the middle of it. And yet, Killing Them Softly, I loved it, and he's very, very good in it. And you see him standing up to people like Gandolfini and Dead Dad from 6 Feet Under, and he's there as an actor, and he's thesping his little heart out, not throwing furniture at the wall for a change, managing to get through entire scenes without eating anything, and he's good.
I'm glad you mentioned Moneyball, actually, because I think that the thread running through those two films is Plan B, which is Pitt's own production company.
Right.
And so I think that whatever he's doing with that stardom, he's doing the right thing. He's picking good projects. He's making good work happen and leveraging the profile that he's got. And
there are people who hold the insane view that the men can act.
I know, there are.
Are you talking about me?
I'm talking about me.
I do too. I think Brad Pitt's tremendous. And this is not a girl talking, going, he's so good looking. I honestly think he's he's tremendous.
In the way that I think Emily Blunt is incredibly talented as well.
Oh, I think she's great too.
Oh, okay.
So, yes.
Right. No, I think fair enough. I think that I've come to admire Brad Pitt's work in independent cinema, and I thought that he did a fantastic job in the Terrence Malick film last year. I thought that he's got something going on when he's got the right director working with him, and I think he understands that and chooses.
Terrence Malick is famous for giving every single scene 240 takes. I mean, surely out of 239, even I could have ripped out a good one. I also think, I will give you a deal. I don't think he can get through a script without moving his lips, but when he has read a decent script, at least he recognises when he sees it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Don't forget, though, of course, he did the Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford with Andrew Dominik, and that's where they forged a very strong working and personal relationship. I thought he was tremendous in that film, and I thought that was actually a superior film, and that's why they work well together. And Dominik just sort of he trusts what Pitt's going to do, and vice versa, you know.
Yeah. I was fast asleep at the time.
That's a film that I need to revisit on the basis of like after watching Killing Them Softly. I think I was like, oh, maybe I missed something in that Jesse James film. But Killing Them Softly, it's got so many charms and so much to admire, but even the flaws are sort of admirable flaws, aren't they?
They're deliberate flaws. Yeah. They're in-your-face flaws.
Exactly.
I love the James Gandolfini
story. Look, I have a subtext and I'm going to rub it in your face. Now I'm going to rub harder.
The whole story arc of James Gandolfini, the fact that this fat alcoholic turns up on a plane, achieves absolutely nothing towards driving the plot forward, eats up about 30 minutes of screen time, during which he has, I think, maybe two interesting conversations, insults some women, gets on a plane and goes home. And if you're looking at that as a script editor, you'd go, those 50 pages go in the bin, because actually nothing happened for the entirety of the film while that was on. Please cut to the chase. And yet it was the most, to me, is my favourite part of the film was Gandolfini's non-story arc. The fact that he wandered into the film, did precisely soddle and then wandered out again.
Yeah. You mentioned Richard Jenkins earlier on, and who's one of my favourite actors of all time. And he, I think one of the great pleasures that I had at the movies this year was Cabin in the Woods, which featured him and what's-his-face and Bradley Whitford from The West Wing. And they even open that film with a walk and talk, which I just thought, I'm just going to enjoy this now. I'm here. You've got me.
Yeah.
And, you know, Richard Jenkins, he really is, you know, he's an unlikely movie star now, but he is just fantastic, isn't he, in everything he does. And
he's almost picked up the J.S. Simmons mantle of like the lovely avuncular face who can jump up and kick your ass if he needs to.
He got his name on the poster for Killing Them Softly, and that was like, yes, well deserved.
You're gonna see him
that
again
poster
today.
That said Graham Pitt and some other people.
Graham, didn't you tell me that you were going to go and see that new Tom Cruise project? project later on this evening?
I'm going to go and see Reacher at 6 o'clock tonight. Yep.
Well, you'll be seeing Mr. Jenkins again, I believe, in a very similar role.
Not his best work, let's be honest.
And he was great. He was so good.
It was such a thinly written role, David.
Anyone who does their best work,
it was meant to be.
Easy Tigers, all of you. Yeah. Let's hold that because some of us haven't seen it, we will be featuring it on the show when it comes out. But maybe we'll have a little bit of a round table at the end, just to sort of what are we looking forward to. So just maybe save some of that. Early 2013 stuff for then. Now, Graham, your biggest surprise?
My biggest surprise is the fact you just asked that question. No, I think my happiest surprise of the year was probably Avengers, or I went expecting absolutely nothing and just enjoyed myself from beginning to end. Happiest surprise of the year was probably The Sessions, which is a film I kind of put off seeing, going, oh my god, I'm really not ready for paraplegic sex at this point in my life. And then when I found it immensely moving, I thought Helen Hunt gave a fantastic performance. If John Hawkes isn't at least nominated, and hopefully just bloody wins the thing for Academy Award this year for what he did.
I thought that was
a film I was expecting to sit through and admire but not enjoy, and I found myself actually enjoying it.
Hawks himself was a big surprise as well, considering how terrifying he's been in films over the last few years with intense presence that he has, to be so gentle.
Everyone remembers Jennifer What's-Her-Face, but to me, like, his performance in Winter's Bone is still the heart and soul and the spine of the film. Mm-hmm. I love the way that his journey actually echoes hers. We just see less of it, but we know that he's tracking exactly the same path that that Jennifer Lawrence is tracking.
Mm. And I liked that in Martha Marcy May Marlene, he, playing the cult figure, didn't play it in a stereotypical kind of I'll just be really insidious kind of way. It was so nicely nuanced for me that I could see why she was sort of would fall in love with him but feel manipulated but feel forgiving, and you know, that kind of ambiguity. So I think you're right. I think he's a tremendous actor.
He's just such an intelligent actor, isn't he? He can't conceal the fact that there's a great brain ticking away there.
Yeah. We've got a special guest now, an interview that I pre-recorded a little bit earlier on in the week. Glenn Kenny is a gentleman that I met while I was on my tour of the United States earlier on. He's the former chief film reviewer for Premiere magazine when it was still a magazine, and is now the chief film reviewer for MSN. He blogs at somecamerunning.typepad.com, and I spoke to him about his year from a New York or a Brooklyn perspective. Glenn, welcome to Cinematica.
Hey, thank you for having me, Dan. It's really great.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. 2012, what sort of a year has it been for you cinematically?
I felt really good about it cinematically, and I wasn't feeling too great going in. The first few months of the year were even more dire and arid than I had expected, and I wasn't really sure what the year would bring. But when I came down to do my best of list, I felt pretty comfortable this year doing a 25 best as opposed to a 20 best, which I used to be able to keep it down to. So I was impressed by the high quality of a lot of mainstream films. I didn't see as many off-the-beaten-path pictures as I might have, although looking at my list, it might seem that I did. But I was pretty happy with the state of cinema in terms of individual products. There was a lot of good stuff across the spectrum.
25 seems like an indulgence.
Yeah, no, it's this week I'm going to be putting up on my... Well, it's, you know... It's a great thing in film writing today is that for my work at MSN Movies, which is where I do most of my professional reviewing, I was asked to submit a list of 10, and I did, and that was fine. But for my blog and my discussions online and so on, it seemed permissible to let the hemline, to let the waistline out a bit and be a bit expansive.
Well, that's fantastic. I haven't yet had a chance to put my best of the year together, so I'm hoping that your list will actually prod me in a few directions and remind me of things that I may have forgotten. Should we start at the beginning? What was your cinematic highlight?
I think it had to be The Master, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, which is still just a remarkable thing inside of me now, in terms of the in terms of the way it looks, in terms of its emotional power, in terms of the mystery of it, in terms of the very primal pull of its theme, what it's treating through its characters, the performances. I thought that was a remarkable film, and an enigmatic film, and a not an ingratiating film, but really a terrific achievement with a lot of very very multiple kinds of resonances. Not all of them pleasant, even. But a real orchestra work of a film, for sure.
Anderson's film is a film that has not yet screened in New Zealand, not even in under any festival guise. And for quite a while there, it looked as if it may not get released in New Zealand at all. And in fact, my understanding is that come February time, it's only going to go into the two of the three main centres here. And has the audience response in terms of box office been enough to sort of to match the sort of, I guess, the impact on you and on the audiences who have seen it? Like, is it doing the business?
It's kind of a shame. I don't know that it got to all that many theaters in the United States. I think it can be categorized as certainly a box office disappointment. Like I said, it's not an ingratiating film. It's not as if it's an experimental picture with a lot of disjoints and non-narrative poetic imagery in terms of a Malick picture. I mean, it does have a conventional structure in terms of, you know, its scenes of characters interacting, and, you know, it goes off into dream territory once or twice in the latter portion, but it has the same relation to rationality that a Kubrick film in the period of The Shining might. But that said, it's not friendly. It's a movie about difficult people, and there's something about it that I wouldn't say seems impenetrable, but is not yielding. It doesn't cozy up to the viewer, and it had a hard time being sold as such. And not only does it not cozy up to the viewer, but it doesn't really offer much in the way of a conventional resolution. So it does all sorts of things that are not expected, and I imagine that it must have been some kind of a marketing challenge for the Weinstein Company. I don't think it's a marketing challenge they met very well, because I certainly, you know, I wouldn't second guess it, but I would have put it out. I would have done it differently, I guess, but. I think it's a film that will continue to resonate. I think it's a film that has staying power. I think future generations will look at it and look into it and be moved and intrigued by it in the same way that, you know, not to bring up Kubrick again, and it's not necessarily an even good analogy, but, you know, Barry Lyndon wasn't considered a particularly dramatically compelling film when it first came out, and it's a movie that in subsequent years has been discovered and rediscovered by certain generations of film goers who are rightly impressed by the power of it.
We're talking about The Master with Glenn Kenny from Brooklyn, New York, the chief film reviewer for MSN, and we're discussing Glenn's sort of highlights of the year. There are quite a lot of the awards contenders for 2013's big noting awards, the Academy Awards and the Golden Globes, etc., that have yet to arrive on New Zealand screens, which tends to be the way a lot of New Zealand distributors hold those until nominations for those big awards are announced so that they can ride the wave. I'm thinking about things like Lincoln, Zero Dark Thirty, Hitchcock,
And what do you think in terms of the highlights of those sorts of films that are still to come for New Zealand audiences?
I'm very high on Lincoln. I think Lincoln is an exemplary historical fiction. Very well done, beautifully acted, intriguingly written, a real achievement. Zero Dark Thirty is a very controversial film. You called while I was in the middle of drafting a defense of the film against the depredations of well-intentioned political pundits who believe the film endorses torture, which I don't. I do not believe it does that. But by the same token, I don't believe it condemns torture either. I think that it is a very deliberately ambiguous kind of treatment of this of you know torture in this geopolitical context.
If ever there was but if ever there was a film that endorsed torture, it would be Wreck-It Ralph.
You know, I missed that. I hear that there is some yeah, somebody, you're not the first person who's mentioned it, however.
Yes, a gobstopper gets some fairly awful psychological and physical treatment and gives up the ghost very early on. It's there's no resistance shown whatsoever. So I think that's sending out a very dodgy message to to the world's young people.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll have to check it out on the DVD. It's a tough film. It's a, you know, I think it's being misunderstood by a lot of people, but there are people who generally don't write about films, and you know they're attacking it in such a way as to suggest that people who write about films don't know what they're talking about. So, you know, I'm trying to engage the issues without seeming too defensive.
Yeah,
but it's a movie that's going to have legs, at least in terms of. You know, what they call the cultural conversation.
And another film that you've engaged with quite a lot online is Hitchcock, which stars Anthony Hopkins as the great director. And that's a film that I know a lot of people are looking forward to here.
I'm afraid my feeling about it is that it's pretty dreadful. You know, I've been told that my perspective is one of hero worship because Hitchcock is one of my favorite directors. But, you know, I'm not 12. I know that Hitchcock was not an entirely pleasant individual. I know that a work of fiction has the right to take creative license with facts. What I do demand, or what I do expect when a film, when a film takes this kind of license with facts, that it creates something relatively diverting, engaging, and entertaining. As a fiction, and this doesn't do that. It depicts Hitchcock as a puerile man-child, and his wife is also portrayed as a rather petulant ninny. You know, they're poring over rushes of Psycho, and she's saying, "Ooh, got a bit of nudity in there," and he's like, "Oh yes, I've sneaked it past the censors," as if you know these are just they're like snickering adolescents, which is what. You know, the American film executive tends to think his ideal audience is so.
And it tends to be what they think a lot of film directors are.
Reduced to this kind of caricature is painful. To see it happen to a director who was one of the greatest artists in cinema history is more so.
So, Glenn, just to sum up, your top 10 can be found at msn.com.
It will be found at msn.com, and it'll also be found this week on my blog. I'll be counting down my top 25 films, starting today and ending on Friday, with explanations and links to reviews and random notes.
That's brilliant. I'm looking forward to comparing notes with you, Glenn. Thanks very much for your time, and we'll talk to you in 2013.
You bet, Dan. Thank you.
So now it's my turn. I will just be very brief because I think I've expounded at length already about my favourite film of the year. And this is an example, I reckon, of where we just have to put aside all objectivity. We should just stop pretending, frankly, that what we do in this business is objective or somehow measurable.
He knows
or...
he's about to say something indefensible,
yeah,
and he's winding up.
Come on, Dan. It's okay. Twilight, isn't it?
All right. So this is a film that that frankly I want to be buried alongside when I go. And in fact, I'm pretty much. I think I'm already sleeping with it under my pillow. So. This is Paolo Sorrentino's This Must Be the Place, which every so often you come across a film that so its theme, its subtext, its presentation, its aesthetic so meshes with your own interests and your own history and your own enthusiasms that you simply you're fused to it. Almost. And I sat there watching this, a very, very scratchy print during the film festival, thinking this film could have just been made for me and me alone. It just grabbed me so much. Anybody else around the table seen this one?
Afraid no. not. I would love to administer a savage mauling at this point, Dan, but I'm just not qualified to do so.
This is no, okay.
I can't believe you've given yourself a free pass.
Yes, it's Sean Penn.
Sean Penn plays an aging former rock star who resembles Robert Smith from The Cure in terms of his look, in terms of the big black hair with the hairspray, in terms of his sort of his character. He's a little bit. Ozzy Osbourne-ish, a little bit vague, a little bit like you feel like he's taken one too many drugs. He's a tax exile in Dublin, married to Frances McDormand, who is a Dublin firefighter, ladies and gentlemen. So it just gets better and better. He spends his time.
And this all echoes actually, your life, doesn't it?
I remember very clearly poring over the film festival program, trying to decide whether to include that one on my list. You know, when you get to that stage and you've got 50, 100, 150 films, and you've got to get it down to something manageable. And I read the description of that film in extreme close detail, and I came to the conclusion that it would be absolutely unbearable.
I will go and see anything with Sean Penn in it in the same way as I'll go and see anything with Al Pacino in it. It's just
it was
boring. It was all of those things, and it didn't matter because it was purely he arrives in New York for he gets the news that his father is very poorly, and he decides that he has to leave Dublin to go and pay one last visit. But of course he won't fly, and so he has to take a cruise ship, and by the time he gets to New York his dad is dead. And so,
already I like it.
And he goes to see his friend David Byrne, who is playing in
this
a New York club.
It is David Byrne.
And the whole film stops
it's
for
not
a
like
complete
Emily Blunt playing David Byrne
for a complete performance of This Must Be the Place, which is just beautiful. And it's not it's not like one of those moments in where they play music in films where you have the first 30 seconds and then they go off and talk while music plays. They just play the whole thing live.
So it's a Tremé moment.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And he discovers at his dad's funeral that his dad
wasn't his father after all.
No, but he knew that his dad was an Auschwitz survivor, but he didn't realize that his dad had been obsessed over the last sort of 40 years of his life in trying to track down the prison guard who had humiliated him during his time at Auschwitz. And so Sean Penn decides to stay in America and takes a road trip across America to hunt the Nazi who humiliated
his dad.
Picks
up the father's torch sort of thing.
Yeah.
What a great quest.
It's just...
okay, now I really want to see this.
We're on the moons of Pluto.
Seriously,
no,
I just...
Has it had
a
general release? Will it get one?
No, and it went straight to video.
At the risk of sounding facetious, is it based on a true story?
No.
Right.
No.
So you've given me my homework, Dan.
Yeah.
I admire the writing even more.
Okay.
That's not
I'll
based
sit
on
myself
a true
down.
Story.
I will watch this film.
Yep. All right. So my
it will be your fault.
Yes, indeed. And I expect we will be jousting on Facebook, as we've just been talking about jousting on Facebook about the good, bad, or indifferentness of it at some point. So please make that your summer holiday homework.
Okay.
Now my surprise of the year. This one was again one we've talked about off air a little bit earlier on. I was not expecting to enjoy this. I was told that the only way I was going to get to see this before it was released was to go to one of those Chicks at the Flicks screenings at the Embassy Theatre.
Yeah.
I turned up. I was the only man on his own at the screening. I forgot to bring my notebook, so I was sitting there alone at the screening. I didn't even have a notebook to so that people would go, "Oh, well, he's a journalist. That's the reason why he's here." instead of looking at these girls with their glasses of champagne, looking down at me sitting alone in the theatre, going, "Why isn't he wearing a raincoat?" Because that's
clearly what he's here for.
Yeah, indeed. So this is Magic Mike, right? This is the film about male strippers, and so there I was sitting alone, watching this. And by gosh,
Dan, I went to that one on my own as well. And actually, I have to say, if only we could have gone together, yes, that'd have made a whole different set of assumptions.
It says a lot about the fabulousness of the women that I know that none of them would accompany me to this film. And
but wasn't it great?
It was good.
Wasn't it entertaining?
It was so much fun.
I walked in going, "Oh God, it's Wednesday, 6:30. In the interest of doing my job, I have to see this bloody film about male strippers." And then Steven Soderbergh's name flashed up on the credits, and I went, "Hang on, what's he doing making this?" And about 5 minutes in, you just relax and go, "This is about a million times better than I was expecting." It was a good little, good plot.
I've started to see the appeal of Channing Tatum. Not necessarily in quite the way you might think, but he's starting to develop some drama chops and some romantic comedy chops, and I suspect that there's a future for Channing Tatum. And as a producer of the film, you get the impression that
when that fabulous ass starts to sag, he's still going to have a job.
But Matthew McConaughey,
what a
brilliant performance from Matthew McConaughey. Even getting the bongos out was just a brilliant touch, wasn't it?
That's not a metaphor.
Yes, literally getting the bongos
getting the bongos.
Sarah, what was your impression of Magic Mike from the female perspective?
Similar to David, I was a bit like, "Oh, this is just going to be a dumb girl stripper movie." And when there were mostly women in the audience that I went to, even though it was a press screen or a media screening, Steven Soderbergh's name, and I was like, "Oh, okay, no, that's right. This is going to be..." Because I don't like Channing Tatum, and I certainly didn't before Magic Mike. So I thought, "Oh, well, that's interesting. A director I really respect and admire with an actor who I have no time for whatsoever, because as we've said earlier, I'm a little bit judgmental and a little bit quick to leap to conclusions." Boy, can the guy dance, though. Mm. And so the dance scenes, the way they moved and everything was fantastic. You can take that however you like. I thought it was really good. I thought it was a very unusual choice for Soderbergh, and I thought it was a fantastic twist on the traditional sort of female audience-friendly kind of eye candy kind of film. I liked the fact that it actually got freaking dark, and it was grim.
It was all about Eve, wasn't it?
Morality tale and all that sort of thing.
I think it was all about the emasculation and commodification of the American male working class, darling.
Yes, there was that too. There was that about it too. So
I think the great irony of this surely is that the four professional film reviewers sitting around the table all enjoyed the film far more than the Chardonnay-soaked harpies that actually went to see the damn film.
Yes, but you know why they
did. Who all thought it was boring.
Because of the Soderbergh effect. Because it was a little bit grim, because it was a little bit real life and harsh, and somebody had a drug overdose,
there was a good
puked in their mouth
in
and
there.
Stuff like that. Yeah. It made it that little bit unsavory for your Chardonnay-soaked traditional Joe public audience or audience. That's what I think.
It was 10 times better than Pitch Perfect, which did actually get that audience.
Right. Yeah. That film really disappointed me. I'd heard really good things about that film by the time I went to it. And it was a bit of a bother.
Can I just say that Magic Mike also had my quote of the year, and it's not actually in the film, but walking out of the film with a phalanx of aforementioned Chardonnay-soaked harpies, one of them said, "That was awful, I only saw one dick." I actually missed that, but apparently there's one in there somewhere.
Yes, there is. Yes,
a phrase you could apply to so many films.
Hard to miss. Okay, so time to wrap up with our trends of the year, and we'll see if we're in agreement about these things. My trend of the year, I'll kick off.
I want to go first because
obvious. You usually want to go last.
I want to go first with this because it's what everyone else will have.
Yeah.
Films for older audiences.
Right.
There have just been so many of them, and I really think that producers have finally figured out that there is a large older audience who would like to see films about their time of life.
And who recognise that television is rubbish And those people who would normally sit at home watching quality drama on television aren't getting it, so they've got to go and find it somewhere else.
You know, so we had Best
so
Exotic,
they're the only ones
and
with
we
the money
had
and the time. Yes. You see, they get their OAP cheaper tickets, so they're invariably paying $10 or $11, not $16.50, and they go during the day and they see everything.
Why don't the people who program TV One click onto this? It's like there actually is an audience out there that aren't downloading everything onto their bloody iPods. They are sitting down and watching the telly with a cup of tea, and they'd like to see something bloody decent, and they've got a spare buck to spend on advertising. So why doesn't TV One start showing some quality stuff?
Indeed, indeed. Sarah, what was your trend of the year?
I've noticed, and it probably started last year, but it's the ostinato string soundtrack that we love from all the Bourne movies that now every bloody thriller slash action movie seeks. They've jumped on board. So you get the kind of effect. You know what I mean by ostinato. And I'm sure that I've heard it, obviously, in the latest Bourne film. I think Taken 2 ripped it off a bit. There were hints of it in Bond, in The Dark Knight. And possibly in Argo as well. I wouldn't have been at all surprised. And that seems to me to be the staple kind of soundtrack. And it works. I mean, it pisses me off because I think
I love it in the
you're
Bourne
not doing anything
films.
Original and this belongs to Bourne.
Can I just
or
say,
you
Sarah,
not get out.
What a
but it evokes
trend.
Bourne, and therefore I think it sort of heightens the it gives that quality feeling.
All right. Graham, what's your trend?
So there's a joke you get on film sets and whenever the sound recorder is complaining about, you know, the conditions he has to work under, and people turn to them and say, look, mate, no one's ever said heard any good films lately, which is, ha, 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 ha. But you've actually just proved us all wrong because you have spotted a trend and it's oral. And as soon as you said it, I went, by thunder, she's right. I never would have spotted that in a million years.
Now you see it everywhere you go.
Trend of the year, I'm going to agree with David completely about movies for the 50, 55, 60 plus audience. I would go out on a limb and say, look, it's been 4 years since Mamma Mia came out. Mamma Mia went down as making more money that year all around the world than Batman did on about a third of the, about 25% of the budget. It takes 4 years to make a film. It's the producers going, right, we've got the scripts, we've shot them, we've produced them, we've marketed them. 3-4 years later, here it is. Let's make some money out of the wrinklies, because obviously we'd underestimated the audience. So it's the post Mamma Mia wave is what we're getting now, and it's yielding some quite decent drama. Plus Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which obviously is a genre of
which is getting a sequel,
which we call a genre of wary.
I have a couple, actually. One is just simply the internet fanboy overhypedness of the big tentpole pictures, and the fact that you can't go, you have to avoid social media after a while because of the Dark Knight Rises and the intensity of that.
Prometheus was the thing that brought
that was
that
the
to
first one, yeah, exactly.
Apex.
That was the first one this year where I just went, wow, I'm so excited. I was being
but
played
that was
like
six
a violin.
Months before the film.
I was being played like a violin, and then the film turns up and it's like,
I was going to say, that's Prometheus probably is my surprise of the year, and then I went expecting something quite good, and within 10 minutes just slumped in my seat going, this is a pile of shite. How could it have they got it so wrong?
So that overhypeness. Looper was another example of something that the fanboys got hold of before. People have.
Looper was a damn good film. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Okay, Looper was mildly underrated.
We're already seeing this trend for next year with the online commentators analysing the Star Trek teaser trailer second by second. The excitement that they had that the Japanese trailer had 15 more seconds in it. You know, it's like, please get a life, you people.
The world's always been full of people with nothing better to do than squeeze their acne and argue about films. Just because of social media, we actually get exposed to them at a time of our life when we should be gratefully free of all that.
to be fair, I think the four of us ought to be wary of calling the pot black here.
Yes.
Being the pot, calling the kettle black.
We should be wary of something. We can agree we should be wary of something.
People out there doing real jobs in the real world going, I can't believe people sit around and talk about film and argue about people talking about film all the time.
I decided I wanted to be a film reviewer because I read whoever it was who had the Dominion or the Evening Post at the time, and they didn't get RoboCop. And I was so angry about it that I decided then and there, at the age of probably about 18, that one day I'm going to be the film reviewer for the Dominion.
And on that note, four people sitting around a virtual table discussing films, which I'm sure infuriates normal citizens that we get to do this. Thank you.
Get paid very much.
Ed Ordle. Thank you very much for your time, everybody. From my left, Graham Tuckett from the Dominion Post. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Absolute pleasure. Cheers.
David Larson from the New Zealand Listener. Thank you very much again for coming down to see us.
Always a pleasure.
And online from Auckland, Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times. Thank you.
highlight of my day.
Brilliant.
Nice to virtually meet
I've
you.
Been Dan Slevin. We also heard from Simon Wherry and Kaylee Carruthers and Glenn Kenny. That's it for 2012 for Cinematica. We'll be back bright and early in 2013 watching everything. So sometimes you don't have to, and sometimes we're recommending stuff. You never know. Thanks very much for your time listening. Cheerio.